All right, terrific. We're ready to hear you then in the case of Scalzot versus Scalzot.
Good morning, Your Honors. Sam Levin on behalf of Heidi Scalzot. This case comes before you after what's been more than a year of fairly rough and tumble litigation. Kind of began with a bang when Mr. Scalzot filed his complaint for divorce, accusing our client of abandoning him and having an affair with another man, and then claims that it kind of unraveled at the trial court. Over the course of the litigation, it became fairly clear, just in terms of the depositions that were done, the documents that were exchanged, that he wasn't going to be able to prove adultery. At the trial, we have the clear and convincing evidence standard that the trial court, in fact, found he did not live up to. And as a result, yet nonetheless, he persisted. He pushed adultery. He pushed adultery as his ground of divorce. It's fairly clear from the record why. He was earning triple the money that that Mrs. Scalzot was earning.
Let me interrupt you. I think we can cut to the chase here.
Sure.
You rely on Thomas versus Thomas.
That's right,
entirely for your position. A couple things about that strike me. First of all, in Thomas versus Thomas, the party when the court reversed, it was in favor of the party who had prevailed, who had filed for the divorce and received it. In this case, that was not your client. In this case, the party that filed for divorce was the other party. And in looking at Richmond versus Henrico County, where the Supreme Court defined prevailing party, it's the party in whose favor the decision or verdict in the case is or should be rendered and judgment entered. And in determining this question, the general result should be considered, an inquiry made as to who has, in the view of the law, succeeded in the action. So here, you know, your opponent is the one who filed for divorce, received a divorce. There was no cross-filing a bill of divorce that I can see from the record here by your client. So how do we conclude anything other than you're not the prevailing party here, given that standard?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at the entire case for one thing.
But we don't look at the entire case. We look at who filed for what relief and was it received. We don't look at damages. We don't look at collateral consequences, according to what I just read.
Well, I somewhat disagree, Your Honor. I think that a divorce case is different in a lot of senses, because in a divorce case, you have the situation where you can file in an answer, for example, requests for certain things if the court rules in favor of the plaintiff and in other areas. So I'm not sure that that other analysis from outside of the divorce context necessarily makes sense in terms of determining who's the prevailing party. You have multiple issues in a divorce case that comes before a trial court. So first of all, our client did not oppose the issuance of a divorce. In fact, if you look over the record, she fully supported the granting of a divorce on the separation ground, not adultery, not desertion. And in fact, the ground that was ultimately granted by the court, she asked for spousal support, which Mr. Scalzot sought to deny her. She was granted spousal support. She asked for a substantial share of the house, far more than Mr. Scalzot was claiming she should get, and the court's award was much closer to what she was requesting. I think it was about $9,000 less than she was requesting.
So if you get $1 more than the other side, you prevail, no matter what the
I don't think the analysis is quite that simple.
Well, that's the problem. You're asking us to do a sort of you know it when you see it kind of standard, and I'm not sure that's appropriate. I mean, we've basically said Thomas versus Thomas is limited to its facts. I thought it was significant that Justice Mims recently authored an opinion, I think it was about a little less than a year ago, by the Supreme Court of Virginia, where he discussed the award of attorney's fees, and he listed all of their jurisprudence where they have made exceptions or noted exceptions to the general rule that each side pays their own attorney's fees. And I noticed that Thomas versus Thomas was significantly omitted from his list of decisions. So I'm not sure that even the Supreme Court thinks a whole lot of their own jurisprudence.
Well, Your Honor, I would actually disagree with that, because it's not a judicially created exception. The rule for attorney's fees being granted, not necessarily to, you know, being allowed to be granted by the court, is statutorily created. It's actually in the statutes. I don't remember the
actually
the code.
It's not in terms of domestic cases. It's I mean, the award of attorney's fees typically is governed by either statute or agreement of the parties. Now, in suits and equity, which is the where domestic cases were before the merger of law and equity, the award of attorney's fees was always discretionary with the court, barring a specific statute otherwise.
Well, if your honor actually looks back for decades, divorce has always been different. There's rulings going back, and I'm getting outside of the brief to some degree, so not quite sure off the top of my head, but there are rulings that say that the divorce jurisdiction of the court, even though it's a case in equity, is strictly statutory. It has always been strictly statutory. That's why you can't go outside of the specific grants of authority to the trial court in terms of what it can craft in terms of property remedies, for example. So there actually is statutory provisions for...
There's no statutory provision that applies to this case, though, is there?
There are, because attorney's fees are statutorily allowed to be awarded in divorce cases.
Within the discretion of the trial judge.
It is within the discretion of the trial judge, yes.
You are not saying that every time a trial judge, you're not saying that Thomas requires that every time a trial judge awards spousal support, the trial judge also gives that spouse attorney's fees, are you?
Well, what I would be suggesting is that I think that is the plain reading of Thomas, but that the Artis case that this court ruled in 1987 clearly steps away from that. So I can't ask you to overturn Artis, obviously. So I think I am limited definitely by the Artis case, which I think Artis and kind of its progeny of cases kind of gets into the notion that may be the general rule. And I think the Poliquin case might have even put it more succinctly, where it said where a party is capable of paying support and party needs support, fees should be awarded, was the ruling that was the way, wording that Poliquin used. I think that's probably the most accurate statement. And then you get into all of these cases where the court has okayed a failure to award fees. There's extensive fact-finding on the parts of the trial judge. Here we have none.
Well, that's not statutorily required. Is it the way it is in, equitable distribution or child support or
no,
factors?
No, it's not, Your Honor. What I would say, though, is that if you're going to have a general sense, from this court, which I think Poliquin kind of laid out, that fees should be awarded in that situation, that we need to have something from the record for this court to be able to analyze to say, did the court do the analysis that it's supposed to do to say that this is an exception? And I think it's important to note that Thomas and Poliquin and all of those cases are speaking to some award of support. I think if we were talking in this case, if the trial court had awarded our client $3,000, which would have been less than 5% of her fees, we wouldn't have been happy about it. We would have been pretty upset, but I also don't think we'd be here. I think it also matters to understand in terms of Thomas, in terms of even what artists and the other cases have said, that this was an award of zero. An award of zero done without explanation, an award of zero when Mr. Scalzot's own brief in the trial court admitted that the fees Ms. Scalzot incurred were reasonable. I think that's in Joint Appendix page 599. The admission that those were reasonable fees that she incurred. When you have a situation where not only is there support awarded, but you have vastly different asset bases also.
Let's talk for a minute about that, because mm-hmm. the equitable distribution, I understand they make different amounts of money in terms of their mm-hmm. employment, but didn't she get half of his 401k and half of his stocks?
She got half of the marital portion of the 401k,
okay,
which was not the whole 401k.
And, pretty close, though, right?
Yes, but then we're talking about her having to dip into retirement funds to help pay for her attorney's fees, which he doesn't. I think it's significant that it was presented at the trial court that he had over $60,000 of separate assets just sitting in a bank account at the trial court. And I think our second assignment of error is that even if this court doesn't find that Thomas mandates a result, that still it's an abuse of discretion situation. And I think it seems to me that the trial court completely overlooked. We don't know because it didn't explain itself, which is part of the issue we have when it's not going into the record that way. But I think it's almost completely overlooked that he's going to be able to pay off his attorney's fees in a day. And she's either going to have to dip into her retirement savings to do it, she's going to have to spend years doing it. When the court has found that he has this ability to pay, she has this need, he has $60,000 sitting in the bank that's not being touched by the equitable distribution award, it's all post-separation earnings. So for all of those reasons, we also think even if this court finds that Thomas doesn't mandate a result, that it's still an abuse of discretion to award zero. And I do want to, again, emphasize that that's our biggest issue here, is that the award is zero.
The statutory basis upon which you rely, suggesting that the court should have granted fees or costs, is it 20-99? Subparagraph 6, is that what you're relying on?
I believe so, and I think there's a case that I can't...
It says costs may be awarded to either party as equity and justice may require.
Yes, and I believe there's a case, I think it's like Taishieko or something like that, I can't pronounce it, and I certainly don't remember it because I didn't brief it, and I can submit a supplemental letter if your honors would like, but that says that the costs in that include attorney's fees.
It's included in the annotations, I think, right, to the statute?
Yeah, perhaps. Something like that.
Okay. Yeah. We have that. Thank you. Yeah.
So if there's nothing further, your honors, I would just say that I think that this is a situation where if the fee award had not been zero, if it had been small, we'd have been unhappy with it, but we'd have lived with it. It's the fact that this is an award of zero when you have all these disparate financial factors, when you have the fact that Mr. Scalzot dragged her through this litigation for over a year on an adultery claim that he should have known would not prevail, that he would not be able to meet the clear and convincing evidence standard. That it is simply not equitable. It is an abuse of discretion, whether it be under Thomas or just under a general abuse of discretion standard, to award her zero in fees. So we would ask this court vacate the fee award order, remand to the trial court for a proper award of fees.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Levin. We'll step down and greet you and then take up the case of Levy versus Wegman Food Market.